South Florida nursing home is among the highest priority for power after a hurricane. The price of I-95 for a few homeowners and property values in South Florida keep rising. So will taxes? Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. 9 months after Hurricane Irma knocked out power to a Hollywood nursing home, knocking off the air conditioning, contributing to 12 deaths, none of the over 1,000 nursing homes in South Florida are the highest priority to get power back after a storm. Why not? Who decides what priorities take precedent after a power outage? A group of homeowners on the edge of I-95 say the county never bought their homes after promising to do so when the highway was expanded. So now the county is offering $500. And property values across the region continue increasing. What could that mean for taxes and affordability? The Florida Roundup with your phone calls is next. Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. When the power goes out, there are priorities. No nursing home or assisted living facility in South Florida is on the highest priority list for FPL to restore electricity after a big power outage. When Hurricane Irma hit in September, millions of customers throughout the region lost power. The Rehabilitation Center of Hollywood Hills was one. A dozen patients died after temperatures inside the building rose when it lost its air conditioning. After the deaths, the state passed a law requiring nursing homes to have emergency generators and be able to hook them up. But the homes are not on the highest priority restoration lists in each of the four South Florida counties used by FPL. So why not? What is on these lists? And what's the criteria to be considered a high priority to get power back soon after a storm? And how do you find out what's the priority of a nursing home or an assisted living facility that you may have a loved one at? Let us know here as we begin the Florida Roundup this week, right here with power and power outages and restoration after major outages. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576 is our phone number. You can also tweet us directly at WLRN is our handle on Twitter. Marcia Pounds is a reporter for the South Florida Sun-Sentinel who wrote about the prioritization lists for the Sun-Sentinel. She's with us via Skype. Marcia, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Who comes up with these lists?
Yes, thank you, Tom. The counties come up with the lists, or they're supposed to. Basically, they review the last season's list. They're given the list from FPL or whatever utility, and they look at the list and decide if they want to add something or subtract.
So they're given last year's list from the power company that they provided the power company themselves. So it comes from the county.
Correct.
That's where the list originates, is in the county.
That's correct.
But FPL kind of advises and consents on these lists and has to agree to it, right?
Well, yes, that's true. And that's what's happened this season. Palm Beach County turned in its list and everything was okay, but they didn't have any nursing homes or assisted living centers on it, and they were able to meet a guideline of 20% of main power lines that FPL requires. Now, Broward and Miami-Dade turned in their priority list for the season, and FPL rejected them.
So let's talk about the guidelines that the power company FPL has to be on this highest priority list. First of all, Marcia, what does it mean to be on the highest priority list? What if a facility is on there, and we'll talk about what facilities are, what does it mean they can expect?
Well, they can expect restoration in a matter of days, FPL says. FPL has to take care of its own power plants after a storm, et cetera. But as soon as everything is generally up and running, they turn to this priority list to get the critical infrastructure running. Hospitals and 911 dispatch centers are automatically on the list. After that, counties decide what they want on the list.
So that's where the local discretion comes into play. After the 911 centers, after the hospitals, then becomes what's important. And what is the guideline or the guidelines that FPL provides the counties? Because obviously not everything can be the highest priority, because if everything's the highest priority, there is no highest priority.
Yes, that's certainly what FPL says. They need counties to pick that about 20% of the main power lines, pick the critical infrastructure that are on those power lines, because they can't get to everything at once. That may be understandable. But also what's happened here is that Broward, for example, has said, well, we have critical infrastructure on some power lines, and there's a nursing home in that power line. Can't we add that? And they're trying to figure out how to do that. Communication between the utility and the counties has worked better in some instances than others.
We'll have to talk about that. I want to hear about some of those instances when it is working and not working. Marcia Pounds is along with us, a reporter for the South Florida Sun-Sentinel, who wrote about the rejection of the highest priority list suggestions, suggestions that Broward and Miami-Dade made to FPL for highest priority of power restoration after a major outage. How do you find out if you are on that list of maybe the place you work at, if you're at a healthcare facility or you've got a loved one at an assisted living facility? How do you find out which list you're on? What questions do you have? 800-743-9576. We are obviously in another hurricane season. There's a hurricane churning out in the Atlantic right now. Your thoughts on power restoration prioritization after Hurricane Irma and your experiences here on the Florida Roundup this week, 800-743-9576. Marcia, what about those instances of communication success or breakdown, as the case may be, between the counties, their generation of these lists, and FPL's final decision?
Right. Well, FPL told Broward County that it's certainly free to designate nursing homes as part of its list, as long as they keep within their 20% guidelines. But unfortunately, Broward County says it can't seem to get specific information about main power lines and where the critical infrastructure is exactly located. And FPL is citing confidentiality and security concerns. They wrote a letter to FPL rejecting their 2018 list and said, we just can't provide all this information.
So let's talk about this 20% threshold. You've used that term a couple of times, 20% of main power lines. How do you understand that? What does that mean in layman's terms?
Well, there are certain main power lines that power most of the grid. They can't get to all of them, so they ask the counties to pick the certain power lines. And they were going to pick those by the hospitals being on them, the 911 dispatch centers. And then they add other things, airports, gas stations, fire stations, electronically open bridges, water treatment plants. So the FPL
those would
gives
be added,
guidelines.
Marcia, yes. Those would be added, the airports, ports, those kinds of things. Those would be choices that the counties make to add to their list. Those aren't automatically on the highest priority list,
that
correct?
Is correct. Okay. Only hospitals and 911 dispatch centers are always on the list. And then after that, there are choices. Of course, FPL is encouraging counties to select facilities or functions that are vital to the community and ensure the health and welfare and safety of its citizens. But there are some tough choices to be made.
Yeah, there is, right? I mean, for Broward County, for instance, you'd have to think that Port Everglades would be high on that list, since most of the aviation fuel and automobile gasoline in South Florida comes through Port Everglades. Some of the emergency supplies that could have to be flown into Miami International Airport, water infrastructure. You mentioned, water systems. You'd certainly want to be able to get those up and online relatively quickly. We invited FPL, by the way, to participate in our conversation. They sent us a couple of notes. They wanted to emphasize the need for everyone to have an emergency plan for when the power goes off, regardless if they're on the priority restoration list or not, and that anyone who needs power to operate medical devices should have a backup power source. So this 20% threshold, I'll think of it, I'll call them kind of trunk lines, right? And then there's branches that come out.
Exactly.
Through your reporting, Marcy, it sounds like what Broward County specifically is asking is, there may be a nursing home or an assisted living facility that is on one of those trunks. Does the county identify the prioritization by physical street address or by proximity to these main power lines? How does get out in the weeds for us here? Because this is where the details really matter.
Yeah, they identify them by customer number. And so they give a list each year to the counties by customer number. And I think there's some issues there. Perhaps there's been a change in emergency management, just in terms of communication on where that critical infrastructure may be on a certain power line. Perhaps some things have changed. Perhaps they want to add some. There were certain things that were not added last year that are being added this year, or small hospitals. Palm Beach County said that it has not been able to add any fire stations to its list. So that 20% eats up the priorities pretty quickly.
Talking about prioritization and power restoration lists, important certainly here in South Florida during a hurricane season. Marcia Pounds is along with us, a reporter who covered this for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Your thoughts, your comments, 800-743-9576 or on Twitter at WLRN. We'll begin in Miami where Lance is online too. Go ahead, Lance, you're on the radio.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to say that I, you know, FPL has had the electric business here by themselves for many, many years. I believe that it's a subpar system, and I think that if we opened it up to competition, maybe more technology would be able to be brought into that industry, and maybe we can have more underground power lines instead of the clothes-hanging power lines that we have today, which, you know, really gives us a lot of issues and problems, not only when we have hurricanes, but even when we have just a little bit of severe weather. I mean, my power goes out almost, you know, once every 2-3 weeks.
Lance, when you talk about a subpar system, obviously you're talking about your personal experience, but what do you mean by that? Is it just the reliability or is it the cost? Because,
well,
FPL famously advertises some of the lowest electricity rates in the nation.
Well, I think that from what I'm seeing, you know, every 2-3 weeks when I wake up, I've had power outages, you know, throughout the entire year. So when I say a subpar system, I think that it's just not reliable. It's not stable. It's not consistent.
All right, Lance, we appreciate your thoughts there. Marcia, let me ask you about the restoration and reliability. This was a large topic of conversation in the days, weeks, and months, obviously, after Hurricane Irma. And FPL was quick to point out that the hardening, the hundreds of millions of dollars that it has spent of hardening since Hurricane Wilma, allowed it to restore power faster than it otherwise would have. Maybe perhaps not keep the power on in the kind of storm that Irma presented, but was able to restore the power faster than previous storms.
Well, one thing that FPL has recognized after Hurricane Irma last year, which was pretty widespread, knocked out 90% of customers across the state, that the underground utilities did fare better than the overhead power lines. So they are making plans to do some pilots across the state to put some more ground under, more lines underground. So that could be a good thing.
Could you tell us more about what you know about those pilot programs and decisions about where those go? Because obviously it gets down to decisions about these power restoration priority lists with FPL main power outages. How is it going to decide where to put some of these pilot programs underground? Any idea?
That is a good question. There's supposed to be more in communities throughout the state, but they haven't revealed the locations yet, and obviously they have to get permission from those communities.
Sure.
But they're supposed to be spread throughout the state.
Talk to us a little bit more about where it stands with these restoration priority lists for Broward and Miami-Dade counties, these lists that were rejected by FPL. Here we are, what, 5-6 weeks into a hurricane season. What list are they operating off of now?
Yes, they're operating off of last year's list. FPL said that it would, in Broward, go by last year's list. They would add a couple of requests that the county asked them, a small hospital and such, to be put on the list. But for the most part, they're looking at last year's list, which include no nursing homes or assisted living facilities. So Broward and Miami-Dade are both still talking to FPL and trying to see what they can work out.
In the meantime, as I mentioned in the lead, Marcia, the state, of course, passed a law requiring nursing homes and assisted living facilities to have emergency generator capacity. The implementation of that obviously means dollars and time. The hurricane season isn't going to wait for anybody to put those in place. For those who have family members, loved ones, neighbors in these kinds of facilities, how do they figure out where these lists or where these facilities are on priority lists?
Well, they're not on priority lists. So if I had a loved one in a nursing home or assisted living I would go to the management and ask what their emergency backup power plan is. Unfortunately, even though the governor signed off on these permanent emergency rules so that there's up to 96 hours of power, that nursing homes and assisted living have to have that in the event of a storm, only 24% had backup power plans in South Florida as of June 1st, and only 20% statewide had implemented plans by the June 1st deadline. So, a lot of them were given extensions.
You know, you put those two pieces of information together, Marcia, the piece about so many nursing homes and assisted living facilities still without emergency backup power plans, and the fact that none of them are on the highest priority power restoration list. That speaks to, and the odds are against you if you are involved with one of these facilities and curious about their power plans in the case of an emergency like Hurricane Irma presented.
Exactly. It's a little frightening.
What other priority lists or categories are there? Is it just highest priority and then everything else?
Well, the lists have to do with those that are directly impacted by a loss of power and then indirectly impacted. So all the things I mentioned, the types of things that we talked about, airports and seaports and police stations, hospitals, 911, those are all direct impacts. They lose power, and unless they have a generator, and many hospitals do have generators, but they could fail. They are on that list to be restored within at least a matter of days.
How dynamic are these lists? In other words, Marcia, could they change as these discussions with Miami-Dade and FPL, Broward and FPL are ongoing throughout hurricane season?
Well, hopefully they will be able to work something out well into hurricane season almost here. We're, you know, a couple of months away from the anniversary of Hurricane Irma.
Yeah, not too far away, right? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We have one out there, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
Hopefully not, won't impact South Florida. But yes, I'm sorry. What did you say?
So you know, wondering if these lists are dynamically put together. In other words, can they change during the hurricane season as Miami-Dade and Broward continue to have these discussions with the power company?
I think they seem fairly fixed after they agree upon the list, and that's what you're going toward, right? The counties agreeing on a list with FPL. For example, last year I remember being in FPL at the command center and the tragedy of Hollywood Hills Rehabilitation Center happening, and I kept asking them, so are you going to change your list? Are you going to try to get to the nursing homes? And there just was very little response on that. They go by the list, and it's very methodical.
Marcia Pounds, reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel, with us here on the Florida Roundup via Skype, talking about the priority restoration lists for power restoration for FPL and the counties in South Florida in the advent of a major power outage like was experienced during Hurricane Irma. Marcia, thanks for sharing your reporting with us here on the Roundup. Much appreciated.
Thank you so much.
Still to come on our program this week, years after expanding I-95 and making promises to neighbors, Miami-Dade County makes an offer to move homeowners. Details on that coming up next on the Roundup. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening and supporting public radio in South Florida. When Interstate 95 was built, it ripped through Overtown, isolating stretches of the once thriving neighborhood. Years later, when the road was expanded, a group of neighbors found their properties right next to the interstate, and they wanted out. They say Miami-Dade County promised to buy them out and move them to a quieter area. They waited for years. Eventually, earlier this year, they filed a lawsuit. The county then made an offer to buy the homes. Jessica Lipscomb writes about all of this for the Miami New Times. What's your experience about I-95? Did you live or work around that interstate? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9565. 76. Jessica, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Really fascinating piece here, undercovering a lot of I-95. The story well told about being built in the 60s and ripping apart really Overtown, this thriving black neighborhood in South Florida. But this is more modern than the original construction of I-95. This dates back to an expansion of I-95 and a couple of homeowners, including Sybil Lee. Tell us about Miss Lee.
So Sybil actually grew up in Overtown. Her parents moved there when she was about 5 years old. And when she was in high school in the 60s, she and her family got the word that they were going to be evicted because their home was going to be plowed over to build the interstate. So this is something that has kind of followed her throughout her life. Later, she moved out of Liberty City and moved into this nice home on Northwest 100th Street, sort of in the area west of Miami Shores. The interstate at that point was pretty far away from her backyard. She didn't have any issues. And then in the 90s, they did an expansion of that road, and it put it dangerously close to her house.
And describe the home for us and how close.
It's a simple home, one story, three bedrooms. She liked it because it was like country style. but once the highway was expanded into her backyard, in 2001, the state put up this huge 20-foot tall concrete barrier wall that is now, I measured it with my own tape measure, actually, it's exactly 6 feet away from her back door, which is scarily close.
And is it concrete wall, that kind of thing?
Right, yes. Yeah. But an important thing to note there is it's not, if a large truck were to crash into it, it's not supposed to block it. So
it's designed as a sound barrier, exactly. Not any kind of like safety mechanism per se.
Yeah. So she lives in fear that that will happen. She, you know, tries to take showers and cook in her kitchen sparingly, since those are the parts of her house that are closest to this wall.
Has she experienced problems?
Yeah. Before that wall went up, actually, she and the other lady that lives next door to her had cars that would crash over this flimsy chain link fence into her yard. She was watching the Super Bowl one time, and her dad called her out into the yard, and there was a car that literally overturned in her yard.
And so what has happened over the past many years, this expansion of 95 that brought the road into Sybil Lee's backyard and the backyard of her neighbors, dates back, what, 25 years now?
Yeah, that was the early 90s when the road was expanded, and then the wall went up 17 years ago.
And they remained.
Right.
But they say certain promises were made to them. What were those, and what were you able to identify in the paper trail that you uncovered in your report in the Miami New Times?
Sure. So her and her neighbors organized and actually got what they thought was a good result. In 2002, their commissioner then, Barbara Carey Schuler, called three of them into her office and said, we've got the money. FDOT is going to give us these funds, and we're going to...
FDOT, the Florida Department of Transportation.
Correct, yes.
Yep.
And we're going to move you guys into safer housing. We'll pay for relocation. Go ahead and get your estimates for moving and things like that. But that never happened. I was able to trace the money back with some public records requests, and it looks like in 2006, so 4 years after that original promise was made, the grant was still pending, but at that point the county pulled it, saying that the properties were no longer for sale, which is a little bit confusing because the homeowners to kind of dispute that.
The homeowners say they were still for sale. Were there for sale signs in the front yard? Is that the kind of requirement that was necessary for this grant?
No. Apparently, there was a new duplex that was built in the neighborhood, which I think made the whole project a little bit more expensive. The county had originally...
Well, in 2006, the housing market in South Florida was booming.
Yeah. So the plan originally was to sort of buy these houses, and then the county was going to build a park there, but it became pretty expensive, and then the county basically just scrapped the entire thing and didn't really follow up with the homeowners or make other plans.
Speaking of, with Jessica Lipscomb, writer for the Miami New Times, about her report on a group of homeowners right near I-95 in North Dade County that say the county and the state promised to buy them out and move them to a quieter area more than 15 years ago, and they waited and filed a lawsuit. They filed a lawsuit just a few months ago. Why such a great deal amount of time between the expansion of 95 in the early 90s, this sound barrier wall being built 6 feet from some of their back doors 17 years ago, and now, you know, a half generation later, filing a lawsuit.
Well, obviously, these are seniors on a fixed income, so that was definitely part of the hurdle. They did try to file a lawsuit, pro se, they call it, just representing mm-hmm. themselves in court. A few years ago, it was dismissed because they didn't, know how to follow all of the legal proceedings. So they actually just got a new attorney last year, and he's been working on this and filed it just in May.
So they filed the lawsuit in May. They were asking and are asking for what?
Basically what they were originally promised, which is they want their homes purchased at the prices that were promised to them in 2002. They want moving costs and they want to be relocated into new housing.
Are those prices in 2002, are they generally the same as what they are today, or the higher, lower?
Yeah. So part of the problem is, the county still is willing, as I reported in my story, to buy the properties but not pay for any relocation or moving, which is a sticking point. But now that it's been so long, their houses have kind of deteriorated. The wall has dug up these rodent colonies, so they have rat infestations. Mm-hmm. The vibrations are kind of shaking apart the foundations of their home, so they're they have a lot less value than they used to.
And some of the homeowners have reported health issues that they attribute to the proximity to the expressway.
Yeah, I mean, they all have breathing problems. One of the women, Mary, was diagnosed with reactive airway disease, which can be contributed to, like, breathing and pollution. Sybil has blackout episodes. Most recently, earlier this year, she says she woke up on the floor of her bedroom and didn't know how she got there. She had to be hospitalized. Mr. Williams, the other gentleman, also has sort of like a chronic coughing issue that he doesn't really know where it comes from, but assumes that it might be something to do with the fumes.
These are the three homeowners who are the plaintiffs in the lawsuit against the county and the Florida Department of Transportation.
Correct, yes.
And so what has happened since the publication of your initial report?
Well, the county actually, the county attorneys made an offer, a settlement offer to the plaintiffs through their attorney, but it was only for $500 each, which is a number that they found insulting.
That includes the value of the property?
Right, and their attorney's fees. So
and many moving expenses or what else they're
yeah,
been suing for.
It would pay for basically nothing. So.
And so where does the lawsuit stand? Where do these, any counteroffer that the attorney has told you about?
Not yet. This just happened earlier this week, and the homeowners say they're going to reject that offer, and they're hoping to go to trial and hopefully put their story in front of a jury.
The bigger picture here, as I mentioned, I-95 has a very storied past in South Florida, a place where there's not a lot of modern history, but I-95 is one of those roads that everybody relies on, and the history of I-95 and the building of I-95 is one that I think kind of highlights the racial friction and the troubled past that that this area experienced back in the 1950s and 60s, and echoes of which we can still see today.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I mean, I think the argument that these homeowners have made in the past and continue to today is, two of the three plaintiffs are Black. They're all fairly low income, working people, truck drivers, teachers, that sort of thing. And they believe if they had been, wealthier, whiter, that they wouldn't have had these issues.
What is the county and the Florida Department of Transportation, what have they told you about the status of these pledges or promises that were made 17 years ago, 30 years ago?
So they haven't really commented on the suit due to the pending litigation, which is pretty common. But I think their position is, we did offer to buy the houses outright in, I believe, 2013. That offer was rejected by the seniors because it no longer included the relocation or moving costs, which was important to them. So they're kind of at a standstill now.
And are there other types of neighborhoods, other neighbors that are watching this kind of case? I mean, there are stretches of I-95, as you're familiar with it, while you're, 20, 30 feet up in the air. But if you're in the passenger seat and can and have the ability to do so, you can look out and you can see the roofs of large swaths of residential neighborhoods.
Yeah, I mean, I was curious to find out that myself, too. I haven't heard from anybody else in quite a similar situation mm-hmm. being exactly so close, but I'm sure there are plenty of other areas in the county experiencing the same thing.
And for Sybil Lee, as you mentioned, she had to move originally. Her family growing up was relocated and dislocated because of the original building of I-95. And then here she is still again in her later years dealing with this road. How does she think about it? How does she talk about it?
She calls it the I-95 nightmare. She's really angry, and she has every right to be. It's something that has broken her family apart before. She's supposed to be enjoying her golden years, as she says. Instead, she's just blacking out on her floor and can't even flush toilet paper in her toilet. It's pretty sad.
Why is that? Because of the infrastructure?
Yeah, once
damages?
The wall went up, it messed up the sewage systems. So she and her neighbor both don't have that option anymore, which also makes it hard to, host family over, friends. They're embarrassed about it.
Do they have a place to go if they are relocated?
On their own, they don't really have the means to relocate themselves. But I did talk to them about where they would like to go. One of the men said he would, think about going to California. One of the other women wants to stay in the neighborhood but move farther away. And Sybil says she wants to get out of Miami-Dade altogether because she believes it's too corrupt.
Jessica Lipscomb, writer for the Miami New Times, writing about a trio of homeowners near I-95 in North Dade County who have sued the county and the Florida Department of Transportation, saying they've waited for years for the county to buy them out and move them to a quieter area. Jessica, thanks for sharing your reporting with us on the Roundup. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
We got more to come. Speaking of property, what about your property values? Well, odds are it's on the way up. So will your property taxes be next? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576 as the Roundup continues after this. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. So in Coral Springs, the property value is going up 6%. In Hialeah, almost 8%, almost 10% in Lake Worth. The booming business of owning property in South Florida. The value of existing properties across South Florida is up in most areas, probably in your neighborhood, maybe even your home or your office. With higher values, though, comes the possibility of higher taxes, and the equation hurts affordability in the already high-cost South Florida housing market. This is where we're at now here on the Florida Roundup, 800-743-WLRN. Have you taken a look at your assessed value of your property if you're a homeowner, a condominium owner? What does it look like over the past year or so? Are you prepared for the higher tax bill that could mean in the months ahead? 800-743-9576. Larry Barshefsky is a reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel with us via Skype, and Brian Bandel is a reporter for the South Florida Business Journal. To both of you gentlemen, welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Larry, walk us through some of these numbers here. Where do they come from, and how good is it to be a property owner in South Florida this year?
Well, it continues to be good if you're a property owner. The numbers are put together by the property appraisers' offices in each county, and they take a value of the home as of January 1st each year. And the numbers have been going up, as you said. That higher value means if you're trying to sell your property, there's a good chance you're going to get more money for it. For the local governments, that higher value means they're going to get more tax dollars from you without having to change the tax rate. So they can go out to the public and say, hey, we're keeping the tax rate the same, but because property values have increased, they're collecting a lot more money from taxpayers for it.
Yeah, the tax bill could still go up, and we'll leave the semantic argument about whether or not that's a tax increase or not for another day. Brian Bandel, what are these numbers tell you? You've had a close eye on South Florida real estate for a lot of years.
Well, the numbers say a couple things. There's a lot of construction in certain cities, and in some cities, the values of existing property did not go up very much, mostly because the luxury condo market was not very hot last year. So Surfside had $1 billion in new construction. It's the property value in the city of Surfside went from $2 billion to about $3 billion, mm-hmm. mostly because of the Four Seasons Surf Club residences, which accounted for most of that.
One building will do that.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about buildings where a lot of units sold for $20 million. So that had a big impact on that city. But the existing values of property in Surfside went down 3.5%. Existing values in...
Now, why is that? What would contribute to that?
Well, just the condo values were selling. Some condos were selling at a loss or the same. You had the same thing in Sunny Isles Beach. Values were basically flat. And in downtown Miami, values were basically flat.
So Larry, in areas where there's a kind of a large number of high-end real estate prices, especially high-end condominium prices, those year-over-year numbers may not look so good. Is that fair to say?
The condo market appears to have been very soft, as Brian was mentioning, those communities in Miami-Dade County, Surfside and the others. In Palm Beach County and Broward, they didn't see those drops in prices. The values are still inching up, and I think all the communities had price their property values increase. But the growth is just phenomenal. Palm Beach County, for instance, added 16 apartment complexes to the property rolls this year, and the property appraiser there says they're expecting to add another 20 next year.
Oh, man. Wow. I talk about that supply in this kind of market, Brian. What does that tell you?
Well, the developers continue to build. Rents are holding pretty stable. They're not going up too much because the construction is huge. In some cases, the vacancy rates are going a little higher, but they continue to build, especially in the urban areas. So that's going to continue adding property to the tax rolls. So when you see more property on the tax rolls, you have to ask your city commissioners, are you going to lower the rates for everybody else, or are you going to take all that money? What are you going to do with all that extra money?
It's a good question for the audience here. How about it? If you see cranes in your neighborhood or construction crews in your neighborhood, odds are some of that could be new construction. Those new construction homes or commercial properties, for that matter, wind up on the property tax roll. That means additional revenue for local governments. What would you like the governments to do with that? Are you comfortable with your millage rate, your property taxes? You ready for those to go up even if the millage rate stays the same because your value is going up? 800-743-9576. Your general take on the property market here in South Florida. Affordability remains stretched. And these numbers, Larry, I got to think, tell us that the affordability continues to be stretched in a lot of these communities when you're looking at existing properties.
Yes, and I think one of the things that a lot of the people in the real estate industry has said is these new apartments that are coming online, they're not what a lot of people would consider affordable. They're Yeah. Targeting a premium market that is still strong here in South Florida.
By premium market, let's put some numbers to this, Brian. We're talking, what, $750,000 and higher, $500,000
and
higher?
Well, a lot of the new downtown, like downtown Fort Lauderdale, downtown Miami apartment complexes, for a one-bedroom, you're probably paying about $1,900 a month. For a two-bedroom, you're probably paying maybe about $2,500 a month.
These are rents you're talking about.
These
not
are
mortgage
rents.
Payments.
These are rents because we're talking about apartments here. So yeah, it's very expensive to rent in a lot of the recently constructed buildings. The ones that are more affordable that are coming online are what we call micro units. So developers, maybe you could get 400 square feet and pay like $1,000, but you got to live in 400 square feet.
Right. So the total number may be lower, but the number per square foot is awfully high. Larry Barshefsky, a reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel, is along with us via Skype. Brian Bandel, covering property and all things real estate for the South Florida Business Journal. Your calls at 800-743-9576. The blood sport of real estate in South Florida. Prices continue to go up. Valuations, assessed valuations, are going up. By witness of the latest assessed valuation reports coming in from the three large counties, Palm Beach, Broward, and Miami-Dade County. Larry, when you look across the communities of these increases, where is affordability the biggest challenge? Where does it continue to worsen? And are there places where the affordability challenge may be paused a little bit as the valuations increases have backed off?
I don't think we can point to a specific area where you're seeing more affordability. I mean, you can go through city after city up and down the coast here, and the prices, they're getting good prices for their rents. They're getting good prices for the homes. And the, like I said, the values are up in Palm Beach and Broward counties. They were up in every single community is showing increased valuation. So there's really a push now to see what government can do to see some affordable housing projects built. And I'm not talking about low, when we talk about affordable, we're talking about something that working class families can afford.
What I think is interesting is the cities that are relatively affordable are having the highest increase in existing property values. In Miami, we're talking about Hialeah, Homestead, Florida City, places where people typically flock to an affordable house. Those are had the biggest increases. So it's showing that there's so much fighting for the affordable stock that that's pushing rents in those cities and prices in those cities higher, while the luxury product that's already unaffordable to most people is kind of stagnant. It can't go much higher.
And all three of those communities that you mentioned are far, few of them are very far away from what would be considered the business districts, the urban core of Dade County, certainly. And Larry, you've seen the same thing out in Broward County. The suburbs and exurbs are seeing some of those price increases as affordability is pushing people further and further away from those traditional urban cores.
Yeah. And I don't think you're going to see much of a change. This has been, for the last few years, this has been the trend, and it's likely to continue for a few more years at least, I would think.
800-743-9576. That trend puts even more pressure on transportation systems, certainly, and the environment and quality of life. 800-743-WLRN in Pembroke Pines in Broward County. Christopher is on line one. Go ahead, Christopher, your thoughts.
How you doing? Thanks for having me. I'm born and raised in Miami-Dade County. I now live in Broward County, and I'm now considering moving to Palm Beach County because, you guys are all talking great stuff, numbers and everything, but the reality is that there's nothing great about living in any of these counties because property taxes, values are going up, but, you know, we collect taxes. Does that go to the schools? Does that go to the neighborhoods? Does that go to the infrastructure? You know, I live in Pembroke Pines, and it's like, you know, there's nothing there. Now I have to look norther because, you know, little by little, as the property value and everything and the population continues to increase, you know, what does the local government have to offer as incentives towards the local population? Nothing. I mean, police departments are undermanned. Teachers don't get paid well. I mean, all that sounds good and dandy, but I have a family, and I'm a veteran, so I was lucky when I bought my property using the VA loan.
Yeah, Christopher, thank you for your service to our country. You've put voice to a lot of the frustration that a lot of homeowners, Larry, throughout South Florida have seen, which is that kind of return on investment, not the personal return on investment of seeing your own investment in your house increase in value, but the tax dollars that you're spending each and every year. If Christopher continues to move north into Palm Beach County, what's he likely to find, Larry?
He's probably likely to find the same situation. And the thing is, this year, I don't think you're going to be seeing many cities lowering their tax rates. There's a November ballot, November issue on the ballot that would increase the homestead exemption for properties over $100,000. And so governments are seeing that in the future and are not going to want to do anything to cut their taxes this year because they're fearing the impact of that.
Larry, you brought referendum. Up that homestead referendum. It is an important question that's going to be on a very crowded ballot this fall. It's a statewide ballot referendum that the Republican legislature was able to put on the ballot. Walk us through kind of how this would work. If you're a property owner now and you have a primary residence in Florida, you are eligible to file for a homestead exemption, which essentially takes the first, $25,000 of your home value and takes that off the tax rolls?
That's correct. And then you pay on the next $25,000, and then your value home from $50,000 to $75,000 is taken off again.
Okay.
And now they're asking for a third break. So if your home's worth more than $100,000 to $125,000, you would have that taken out. So it's a third $25,000 break.
And let's be honest here. When we're talking about median home values in South Florida, it's well over, three times that $100,000 level. I think including condominiums and single-family homes, it's anywhere from $300,000 to $350,000 for the average home price in all three counties.
That's correct. So most homeowners will be seeing the full effect of that exemption, of that $25,000 exemption. So they'll be getting a $75,000 exemption overall if it is approved. And that would be not in this year's tax roll, but next year's.
But that doesn't impact the school board, right? The school taxes, right? That doesn't impact that?
I apologize. I'm not positive on that, whether they've once again, because the second $25,000 is exempted from the school board.
Right.
I'm sorry, I don't have the latest on the
It's a
referendum.
Good question. Brian, we'll have to try to figure that out. But what it tells us, Larry and Brian, is how many different agencies of government kind of have revenue streams that are directly attached to home values and property values in South Florida. And that's why it's such an important issue about what those assessed values are and how that winds up into government resources. Tanya in Miami is on line two. Tanya, thanks for holding. Your thoughts on all this.
Hi, good afternoon. Okay, let's start off with I've lived here my whole life, and I was looking to buy a house, and I'm priced out. And what I see is happening is there are a lot of investors who come in, flip a house, and like they're just gobbling up. So what I'm wondering if before, I think during Reagan, there was like a cap on how many mortgages you could hold in your name or your company's name. If anything's, because I don't know, I just see this. And then, gosh, I could just go off on the transit and and people with lower paying jobs, but necessary jobs. I mean, they're not going to have anywhere to live. They don't have a way to get to work because, my God, they should have made that train go all the way down to Homestead and out to the beach by now.
There's
whatever.
The transportation problem when talking about affordable living.
Going up the streets all at the same time. I mean, it's ridiculous. Who's in charge?
So, Tanya, do you own property now? Are you a renter? You talked about being priced out as a native Floridian.
Yeah, well, because, you know, my mom's been living in her house for, my goodness, 47 years. Same house. Right. And then I was thinking, well, you know, let's go in her neighborhood because we were renting. And my God, I mean, it's like every time you blink, they're just going up and up and up and up. And then when you look at the houses online, you know, it's someone who came in and flipped it. And it's like they're just I don't know, man. It's like,
boy, you can hear
I
the frustration, Tanya. I appreciate you calling and sharing your story with us. Larry, when you hear, you know, Floridians like Christopher in Pembroke Pines, we had earlier, Tanya in Miami, talk about what is called now workforce housing or housing affordability, not an official government program of you know, vouchers or rebates and those kinds of things. What has been the response of the development community of not only the high-rise condominium development community, but those folks that are building single-family homes?
I think there's some interest in that community to provide that type of housing, but they're not going to do it without the government, some type of government participation, because the land is just too valuable to build a building, and they know they can get more money from it than the rents that would make it affordable.
Yeah,
so
the economic
they're
incentives.
Definitely the county, like Broward County, has set up this year a $5 million affordable housing trust fund that they're planning to use to work with private developers to get some of that housing into the county.
Larry Barchefsky,
it's going to take money.
Larry Barchefsky, along with us, reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel, with us via Skype. Brian Bandel with the South Florida Business Journal. Brian, we had a question asked earlier about this homestead exemption ballot referendum and whether or not, if approved by voters in November, would it apply to the portion of the property taxes that goes to local school districts? You've been able to do some research here.
Yes, yes. I've confirmed that the property tax rebate will not be from school board taxes. So the school board budget will not be affected. It will, of course, impact cities, counties, so police, fire, libraries, all those things.
And
they'll
as
have
a
to make
single
a
entity, the school board tends to have the largest share of residential property taxes. The rest of it tends to be split upon, you know, counties and fire districts and other types of organizations. Is that fair to say, Brian, in your experience?
Yeah, because the school board covers everything in the county, so they have that. So it won't impact them, but the cities and the counties will have to make a decision on how will this impact their services if it passes.
I'd be remiss, Brian, not to ask you about another real estate play here, and that involves soccer. For 4.5 years now, it has been a parlor game in South Florida about where is David Beckham and his group of investors going to put a soccer stadium for Major League Soccer and a franchise that has been promised and pledged to South Florida. What's the latest?
Well, this coming Thursday, the 12th, Beckham is going with Jorge Mas, the businessman, before this Miami City Commission. They want to at least 73 acres at Mel Reese Park, which is just east of Miami International Airport.
This
That's
a golf course.
Right. Yes. So they want want to lease that to build their stadium. But not only a stadium, they also want 1 million square feet of office space for technology companies, 120,000 square feet of entertainment space, 380,000 square feet of food and restaurants and retail, and 500 hotel rooms and a conference center. So this is actually a big mixed-use real estate play, not only a soccer stadium.
Just like South Florida knows a lot about mixed-use real estate. Any public dollars, though, on the offer?
They're not asking for public dollars, but they are asking for public land. So the question is, are they paying fair value for public land?
Brian Bandel, reporter for the South Florida Business Journal. Brian, thanks for sharing your expertise with us. Appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you.
Larry, great to hear from you as well from Broward County. Larry Barchewski, reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel, with us via Skype. Thanks for walking through the numbers with us, Larry.
Thanks, Tom.
All right. Listen, that is it for this edition of the Florida Roundup. Thanks so much for listening and calling. The Florida Roundup is produced by Bridget O'Brien. Our engagement producer is Katie Leprey. Teresa Frontato, our digital director. News director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. Our program director and technical supervisor today, wearing two hats on one head, is Peter J. Maritz. Thanks, Peter. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for calling and listening and supporting WLRN.